Jackie Lowry lives with her husband, her son, her daughter, her two grandkids, and her daughter-in-law in Antioch, California, a suburb outside of San Francisco. Jackie told KQED that she pays $3,000 a month in rent. Steep, but they could swing it until the pandemic hit and they lost their jobs.
We started falling back on rent, I would say, May of last year. Because it took a while for people to get unemployment and stuff. And then when we did, we were trying to play catch up on bills. We were trying to play catch up on the rent, of course.
Katrina Chisholm lives in Atlanta with her son. She fell behind on her rent for the same reason. And she told NPR that one day last January, there was a knock on her door.
I remember going to the door and the sheriff standing there, and it scared me because I didn't know why he was at my house.
In the sheriff's hand was an eviction notice.
Once you get that eviction, no one's going to want you to rent from them. So me and my son will be, I don't want to be in a homeless situation.
Jackie and Katrina's stories aren't unusual these days. More than 10 million Americans are behind with their rent payments, according to census data examined by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. The federal government and some states imposed moratoriums on evictions during the pandemic, and Congress approved nearly $50 billion to help people catch up on rent. But a lot of that money hasn't yet been distributed by states and counties. The federal moratorium was set to expire tomorrow, but the CDC just extended it for one more month till the end of July and vowed no more extensions after that. But there's an even bigger underlying problem here, of course. The economy will eventually recover. Some people in Katrina and Jackie's shoes will get their finances back in order, get their jobs back, get their lives back. But this nation's housing crisis goes back long before the pandemic, and it'll last long after. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today on Point, the threat of eviction and financial ruin today, and the solution going forward to America's chronic housing crisis. Well, joining me from New York is Emily Benfer, professor at Wake Forest Law School and founding director of the Wake Forest Law Health Justice Clinic. She's also the chair of the American Bar Association's COVID-19 Task Force Committee on Evictions. Professor Benfer, welcome.
Thank you, Meghna. It's a pleasure to be here.
Molly Solomon also joins us. She's the housing reporter for San Francisco's KQED, and she joins us today from Portland, Oregon, actually. Molly, welcome to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I want to talk about the big picture nationwide about eviction moratoriums, but I'd love to actually just start more zeroed in on your reporting in California, Molly, if we could. Can you give us a sense as to what's been happening in the Bay Area, just even over the course of the first half of this year in 2021 regarding evictions?
Sure. You know, California, the Bay Area in particular, is a place that's known for extremely high housing and, you know, unaffordability, you know, way before the pandemic even began. And I think what we saw when the coronavirus pandemic hit and people lost their jobs, businesses shut down, is that we started to see, you know, people were losing their jobs and they would need some level of assistance to stay housed and to make their rent, you know, rents that are incredibly high in this region. And so what we began to see was a broad protections rollout, both at the local, the state, and the federal level. And the real aim there was to prevent people from falling into homelessness, people who had, you know, were unable to pay rent at that time, whether because they, you know, lost their job, they had a family member that got sick, they had to take care of them, maybe they got COVID themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what we saw was probably the biggest government investment, both the protections that came out of that with these different moratoriums, but also just a huge investment in terms of rental assistance, try to keep these people from falling through the cracks and adding to an increased affordability problem, you know, as well as a possibly growing homelessness problem.
Right.
Here.
So did that intervention work? Not just the moratorium, but I'd mentioned sort of the federal funding that Congress had approved. Problem, though, being that it hasn't actually been fully distributed by all states and counties. But has that rollout been better in California?
You know, it's something that's still definitely a work in progress. Mm-hmm. You know, just yesterday, the state lawmakers passed and approved the third extension of an eviction moratorium in California. This now will actually, you know, protect people longer than the federal CDC moratorium that's in place. This is going to protect people from eviction who aren't able to pay their rent through the end of September now. And it also did something really important. You brought up the rental assistance in that it actually increases the amount of aid that, you know, landlords and tenants who have been struggling right now will get paid out to clear some of that missed rent debt. It's going to bring it up to 100% paid out instead of, you know, paying about 80% of the missed rent debt. And that's pretty huge because that could incentivize more people to both apply for the program. Landlords, you know, might be more likely to want to participate. But in terms of rollout, you know, it's been slow, like we've heard everywhere. We last checked, we asked the state for the latest housing data numbers, you know, with their program. They've got about $5.2 billion in federal rent aid to distribute. And so far, you know, from the people that have applied for about half of that money so far, less than 10% has actually gotten into the hands of people who need it. Uh-huh. And before yesterday, before they extended the moratorium, I mean, this was set to expire in a matter of days at the end of June. So that could have meant a whole bunch of people who were just waiting to receive aid, not getting it.
Wow. Okay. So, Emily Benfer, let me turn back to you. How significant or meaningful is the CDC's one-month extension of that moratorium, given what Molly just told us?
I think it's a lifeline. I mean, this eviction crisis is the greatest American tragedy, with over, as you mentioned, 10 million adults and one in five children facing eviction in this moment. They are all victims of the pandemic economy and over a year of severe hardship and health threats. And so this one-month extension could make a difference for their livelihood and even the length of their life, because we know that eviction can actually take years off of your life. So, but I think this all depends on, you know, whether all of these individuals and children survive the pandemic rests in the hands of the state and local policymakers and even the courts, and their ability to divert eviction and connect tenants and landlords with resources that will prevent it.
Mm. Well, I want to talk more about policy and, you know, opportunities moving forward here. But I had mentioned at the beginning of the show that some, according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, some 10 million Americans are still unable or behind, unable to make or behind on their rent. And Molly, we played some tape from Jackie Lowry, who you interviewed in the course of your reporting. And I want to hear a little bit more of that. So, by the way, thank you for sharing this with us. But Jackie told you that even as her family members are trying to get back the jobs they lost in the pandemic, she's fighting breast cancer and has medical bills to pay.
It's just really scary right now. You know, I'm still going to UCSF for my, you know, treatments, of course. You know, I don't have cancer, but I have to prevent it from coming back. So I have to take mammograms every 6 months, and I have to get a shot called a Depo-Lupron, you know, and all these things. And so, you know, I have to have a roof over my head. You know, I just have to. And, of course, my grandbabies, and, you know, they need a roof over their head. And the whole family does.
And Jackie told you, Molly, that she and her family currently owe their landlord around $11,000. And she does fear that eventually they may be evicted. And she described that the enormous emotional toll of that.
Try to hide it from a lot, you know, from a lot of family members. It's like, oh, everything's going to be all right. Everything's going to be all right. But deep down inside, I'm like, this may end up really messed up. This could be a terrible situation. So it's taken a toll on me and my husband, but we try not to show it around the family.
Molly, can you tell us a little bit more about Jackie and her family?
Sure. You know, Jackie Lowry, unfortunately, is, you know, her story is very common. It's something that we've heard a lot. It's, you know, she's a renter in Antioch. It's a suburb outside of San Francisco. She lives there with, you know, her you know, family, her husband, their kids, her grandchildren live with her too. So she's got a full family, you know, that she's housing at her house. And she's been on a fixed income. She retired early because of this cancer diagnosis. And when the pandemic hit, you know, three people in her family, her husband, her son, their daughter-in-law, all of them lost their jobs back in March at the beginning of the pandemic when businesses started to shut down. They had worked at a local card room in the area, and that just had a huge impact on their finances. You know, immediately it was a real struggle to be able to pay the $3,000 a month that it costs for them to rent out the house that they live in Antioch. And, you know, they have a, sounds like a relationship with their landlord. They've been able to communicate that, but, you know, they've had to dip into their savings and basically drain that. They've also had, you know, other tragedies that have happened and other things that have come up in their lives that they've had to step in and pay for. You know, her husband's mother passed away unexpectedly this year and they had to pay for the funeral, and that really, you know, hit them hard. You know, and like you said, now they currently owe about $11,000. That is a big number to look at. You know, not only looking forward, is she going to have to think about how do we continue to pay rent, but how are we going to pay off that kind of debt? That's something that could really hurt families like Jackie's and could hang around for a long time if it isn't paid off, and could follow her and hurt her credit score and potentially hurt future housing for her. I should say that she has applied to the state's rent relief program, but she did that back in March, and it's now the end of June, and she hasn't heard anything back. You know, she hasn't heard if her application has been moved forward. Her landlord is also asking, you know, what's going on with your application? Are we going to get a rent check soon? So I think she's really worried about, you know, what might happen, A, if she never gets that money from the state, but also what if her landlord gets sick of waiting and, you know, these protections expire? Could she get evicted?
Well, we are talking this hour about the one-month extension on the federal evictions moratorium. But what needs to happen after that to solve or at least start getting at the bigger long-term problem of housing instability in the United States? Hop over onto Facebook or Twitter. We're at On Point Radio. And let us know what you think. If you're a landlord, if you're a tenant, what's your current financial situation? What do you think needs to happen? We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the CDC's one-month extension on a federal evictions moratorium. But what has to happen after that as well, in order to get at solving the deeper problem of housing instability in the United States? I'm joined today by Molly Solomon. She's the housing reporter for San Francisco's KQED, covers housing for the state of California. And we've got a link to some of her terrific reporting at onpointradio.org. And Emily Benfer joins us as well. She's a professor at Wake Forest Law and founding director of the Wake Forest Law Health Justice Clinic. And Emily Benfer, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about what we have learned regarding the links between or the correlation between evictions and redoubled impact on people's lives due to COVID. Do we know if there's a difference between, in terms of, let's say, take mortality rates, between states that have lifted their evictions moratorium, or moratoria, I should say, and those that have not?
Absolutely. There's a direct connection between eviction and increased COVID-19 transmission, infection, and death. And part of this is because, and you heard this from the tenants who have already spoken today, that the people who are at the greatest risk of eviction are also the most likely to suffer comorbidities that would put them at increased risk of complications and mortality if they contract COVID-19. And so last summer, I and other researchers led by Dr. Kate Leifheit at UCLA studied what happens after you lift eviction moratoria. And we looked at 27 states just in the summer of 2020, and we found that those states had 433,700 excess cases and 10,700 excess deaths due solely to lifting eviction moratoria. And this could be expected because once you lose your housing, once you're displaced, you double up with others and you reside in cars or homeless shelters where it's impossible to social distance or to comply with any of the pandemic protocol. And so that leads to transiency and couch surfing and public or shared facilities and crowded environments, which, as you might imagine, means that you will have increased contact with others and this inability to adhere to protections that could keep you or others around you safe. So that leads to COVID-19 transmission and ultimately infection and death.
So you have been collaborating, if that's the right way to put it, with the White House as they prepare for a housing summit that's going to take place tomorrow. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That's correct. The White House has taken an all-of-government approach to the eviction crisis and just last week announced multiple initiatives, including a letter from the Department of Justice to state Supreme Court justices asking them to issue general standing orders to divert eviction cases away from the court and to the rental assistance programs and others that could keep people housed. And at the same time, they're hosting a summit on eviction prevention, and there will be a public-facing event where we'll hear from experts like Matthew Desmond and people who are engaged directly with tenants and helping to keep them successfully housed. And then they will have a breakout session with 50 high-risk eviction cities, bringing together the leaders in those communities to collaborate around eviction prevention and to create action plans that they will immediately implement. And this is exactly the type of urgent, swift, and heft of a response that we need in this moment, because the consequences are life-altering and for the worse.
So the goal is to create an action plan that the Biden administration says it is willing to immediately implement?
That the cities will take on.
The cities will take on.
Exactly. So they're bringing together tenant associations, landlord associations, the mayor, the head of the Emergency Rental Assistance Program, and other community leaders, including legal aid, who can collaborate and launch this multi-sector response. Because we know that the holistic wraparound services, this combination of resources, is the most effective way to support families who have been hardest hit by the pandemic and prevent this lifelong devastating harm and exposure to COVID-19. And I just want to mention that the exposure to COVID-19 is still a real risk. While much of the country is currently recovering from the pandemic, the pockets at the highest risk of eviction have not. And we have seen in multiple studies, including from the Eviction Lab, that the higher the rate of eviction, the higher the risk of eviction in this moment, the lower the vaccination rates in those communities. So eviction today for the people who have been the most devastated by the pandemic, specifically communities of color and low-income communities, it will result in increased COVID-19 and the spiraling of the pandemic for them and their families.
So we're going to hear from another renter in just a second here. But Emily Benfer, I wonder, do you feel or do you sense that there's reason to be optimistic that these 50 cities or that the cities that you're talking about can quickly implement whatever the ideas are that come out of this summit? Because, and the reason why I ask with a tinge of doubt in my voice is that you're dealing with a lot of really different stakeholders. And your research and Matthew Desmond, as you pointed out, the research has proven that over time in the past, I'll get this straight in a second, but prior to the pandemic, there was ample evidence that especially large corporate landowner or homeowners, eviction was like a cycle. It was just so much easier for them to evict people. It almost became part of their business model. How are you going to turn that around? How can cities turn that around?
They don't have a choice. In this moment, leading into the pandemic, 50 million renters suffered COVID-19 wage or job loss. Most of those renters are unaccounted for, and that's going to affect the community, the well-being of the entire community, the resources that are available, and their long-term livelihood. So this is a defining moment for policymakers across the country. It's not just about rent arrearage. It's also about addressing the immediate eviction crisis, as well as the immediate eviction crisis being that system that churns people through and wrecks their life and ravages these communities, but also the underlying affordable housing crisis that is harming especially communities of color. We know that the pandemic disproportionately harmed low-income people and people of color, and the recovery must be different. It must prioritize their health and their long-term well-being.
Well, Molly Solomon, give us the San Francisco reality check here. Knowing the different stakeholders as you do through your reporting on housing, are you sensing that there's a more energized, commonly held belief that this is the time to do something about the evictions crisis? Obviously, not just amongst tenants associations, but owners as well.
Yeah, I mean, look, we're in unprecedented times here. You know, I think there is still this common understanding that there is an obligation, a tremendous obligation to get rental assistance that the federal government has set aside for people who need it to get it to them, as well as landlords. I mean, they are a piece of this. And, you know, some of the landlords that we've been talking to have been owed anywhere from, you know, $5,000-$7,000 to like $150,000, you know, some having been getting rent for like over a year now. And, you know, I do think it's important to remember that something like this, the way that the pandemic has really hit housing, especially in a place like San Francisco, probably the center of housing unaffordability in this country, it does affect everybody. And everybody has a stake in fixing this problem. You know, if landlords are hurting, if landlords have to then give up their properties because they're not getting the rent to pay their bills, you know, they have mortgages, they have taxes, they have buildings to maintain. What happens to those buildings if they're foreclosed on, or if they have to sell their properties, you know, off the market and take rental properties off the market entirely? I mean, that could be a loss for renters too, to lose that housing, you know, something that obviously we have a big shortage of in this country. Mm. So, you know, I do think this is an opportunity to think about this in a holistic way. And, you know, Emily was saying here too, it's not just about rent arrearage, but we do have an opportunity here to think differently about housing. And I think that's what's really interesting about this moment. I mean, I don't think anybody expects that these moratoriums are going to last forever. Like, they are going to end at some point. But what happens next? You right. know, how are we going to set ourselves up going forward?
Right. And as you said, I mean, San Francisco, of all places in the United States, has been in the midst of this crisis for so long. I can't imagine that there's a lot of motivation to somehow reduce the pressure across the board that people are feeling staying housed and as they try to stay housed. We're going to talk to a renter here in just a second. But Emily Benfer, we've got a really good question that's come to us on social media. Noah Arroyo says that you just said that lifting a moratorium increased COVID transmission and increased deaths. But what about in cities and states that have pushed infections down to nearly nothing now?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the way that the eviction crisis works is that it's happening in small pockets of cities and states, but in large quantities. So it's clustered in a lot of ways. And it's those areas that are facing the highest rates of eviction and the lowest vaccination rates. And this is documented in both the U.S. Census Household Pulse Survey, that's showing very high rates of eviction risk in very low vaccination among people they've surveyed, as well as by the Eviction Lab, who in every area they were able to obtain data demonstrated this high eviction risk link with the low vaccination rates. And it's not because of an unwillingness to get vaccinated. It's because of significant barriers in those communities, from not being able to take time off of work and risk losing their job, to not having access to childcare or transportation barriers or the proximity of the vaccination site in their community. So multiple issues to really protecting people from harm.
Mm. Well, Emily and Molly, hang on here for just a moment, because I'd like to go to Kansas City, Missouri for a few minutes. Angela Bears lives there and joins us now. Angela, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magma. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being so patient and listening along with us here. I understand that you're a mom of a little boy, and that you had to you were forced out of work for a while due to the pandemic. But you're going back to work tomorrow. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us. Tell us a little bit about that.
So basically, it kind of predates the COVID situation. My two-year-old, he was two at the time, got diagnosed with kidney cancer. I was working and trying to figure that out, and then COVID hit. And while he was going through chemo, he had pretty much no immune system. It was really susceptible to, you know, viruses.
Yeah.
And so I had to drop out of work. I still technically worked at my job, but I had to take a leave to get him through his cancer, his surgeries, and so to not get infected and infect him. So through that, we were working on that, and then when things kind of started getting better, I got diagnosed with a health issue that put me out of work still. Mm-hmm. And then we've fallen behind.
Yeah. First of all, do you mind
if I had signed.
I'm so sorry to interrupt, Angela. I'm sorry to interrupt, Angela, but I'm just my heart is breaking listening to how much you've had to go through over the past couple of years. How's your son doing now?
He is doing great. He actually great. Just woke up, so if you hear talking, that's
okay.
Him. But he just had a procedure from complications from the original surgeries. So we've been dealing with his cancer, my illness, and I had signed up for those rental assistance programs.
Mm-hmm.
And I never got any kind of contact, nothing like even saying, you know, that I didn't make the cut or something, you know.
So you didn't hear anything?
No. And I had signed up three times, and then twice for, like, the utilities program. And, yeah, I never got anything. And on the Kansas City website, it said that a caseworker would reach out to you in 4 to 6 weeks. And I had signed up in March. So, and I still haven't heard anything.
Wow. I understand that your power got cut off just yesterday.
Yeah, I have for the past month been dealing with my son's procedure because they thought they were going to do surgery. He had a blockage. When they had done the original surgery, they had taken out a third of his large and small intestine and also a piece of his colon, so everything in there is tight. And he got a blockage. So at that point, I was more preoccupied with that. My electric got cut off. And I unfortunately had to ask my mom if she could please, like, help us out. Because here, it's really humid and hot. And so she spent the last of her money to get that put on. And so now she is also broke as well after this.
Yeah. Oh, has the, I'm just trying to imagine how you've been holding it together, Angela. I mean, how did the stimulus checks help? I mean, how have you been surviving day to day with all of these challenges happening at once?
I had, at the beginning, I had a sizable nest egg for emergencies, and we could coast off that for a while. And then, you know, the stimulus checks, they didn't really help that much. I mean, of course, something is better than nothing, but, you know, we have medical bills, rent, you know, utilities, food, you know. So I was more betting on my tax refund that I would have gotten $5,000 from, and that would have helped a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I still haven't gotten that.
Yeah. Well, Angela, hang on here for just a second, because we do have to take a really quick break here. And when we come back, I want to actually get a sense from you of what you think might happen next and what you'd like to next for you, and also what you think should happen more broadly in this country. So hang on. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the CDC's one-month extension on the federal moratorium on evictions. But then we're also looking at what really needs to happen afterwards to start pushing back meaningfully against the crisis of housing insecurity in this country. I'm joined today by Molly Solomon. She reports on housing for KQED in San Francisco. And Emily Benfer is with us as well. She's a professor at Wake Forest Law and founding director of the Wake Forest Law Health Justice Clinic, also chair of the American Bar Association's COVID-19 Task Force Committee on Evictions. And we've been hearing as well from Angela Bears. She's with us from Kansas City, Missouri. She's the mom of a four-year-old and had to stop working due to her son's significant health challenges and, in fact, is going to go back to work tomorrow at Amazon as a fulfillment center packer. Now, Angela, I was wondering, through this time when you were unable to pay rent because you had to stop working due to those significant health challenges for both your son and you, how has it been with your landlord? Do you have a small landlord or a corporate landlord? I mean, what's that been like?
So, the man that I speak to, I thought was a landlord. He says there's that he works for the owners of the building. Mm. So I'm not actually quite sure.
Okay, so that's okay. But how about you haven't been evicted because there had been a moratorium in place. What do you think?
Right.
What do you think might happen when federal and state moratoria end?
It really depends. The man that I see as my landlord, he was the one who prompted me to sign up for the programs, and we have a good relationship, but at the end of the day, you know, they are landlords, they want their money, and so I don't know. For the next month, I will be working overtime, probably about every day, to try to get at least a sizable chunk of money and hope that will show them, like, in good faith that I am trying and don't kick me out. Otherwise, if they do, we will have to move about an hour away in the countryside where we'll be sharing a 2-bedroom small house with no AC with my grandma. And Colton needs to stay in the city for now because he has to get, he has appointments for the cancer to make sure it's not coming back. Yeah. And so, you know, I'm just hoping they let us stay if I can make at least a large size chunk of money.
Yeah.
But I really don't know.
I understand that you're trying to mentally prepare for every possibility and even boxing up some of your belongings in case you have to move.
Yeah. Just things we don't use anymore. I've been boxing up and putting into storage. Because like, Mrs. Lowell, I think the woman that was interviewed, you know, I'm just worried about when they arrive with like a sheriff and, you know, evict me.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I want to just open this up just a little bit here for a second. Emily Benfer, you've been listening along here. I wonder if you've got a question for Angela or something that I haven't asked that would sort of help us understand what to do about situations like this.
Not so much a question as a comment. I wanted to say to Angela, I'm so deeply sorry for your experience and this harrowing time that you and your family have been going through. And I want to make it clear to everyone in the room here today that it's not your fault that we entered this pandemic with millions and millions of renters living on the edge of what they could afford, an eviction. And, you know, the evidence is so clear that 70% of renters lacked the 3 months of emergency expenses to cover that type of storm. And a medical bill, a flat tire, was the difference between staying housed and being homeless. And so Angela's situation, I just want you to know that the pandemic itself was resting on the backs of people who were already hard hit. And so this has been your experience as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Angela, just I guess my last question for you is what do you need going forward? And, you know, for the lawmakers who might be listening, sometimes we hear from them and their staff. What's your message for them? What do you think they should do?
Honestly, I think that they need to do away with the debt, if possible, for a lot of the hard-hit citizens. I mean, Kansas City, you know, got millions for assistance for citizens, and I don't know anybody who got approved for it.
Mm-hmm.
Just because the pandemic is slowing down, we're all expected to catch up immediately, and if not, then to be evicted. You know, most of us will become homeless or, as previously mentioned, living with others, couch surfing, and you know, becoming more likely to get COVID. I don't really have any faith in the what they're doing, what the government is doing. And honestly, just do away with it. It's a human right to keep living and have a home. These evictions are just going to make it worse for a lot of people. I think it's going to make everybody lose a lot of faith. I know that I'm starting to, and like, what is going to happen to us? Mm-hmm. Why is the government not helping us? Before this, I pay my taxes. I had a nest egg, you know, to pay for emergencies, you know. I signed up for all the programs and nothing has happened.
Right. Well, Angela, Angela Bears from Kansas City, Missouri, thank you so much for coming on the show and for sharing your story with us. I'm really grateful.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Well, Emily, let me just turn back to you for a second, and then I do actually want to ask a question about smaller landlords, because we're hearing a lot from them over the course of this hour. But, I mean, hearing Angela say she signed up for the programs, didn't hear back from the city of Kansas, Missouri, and that, as I mentioned earlier, some states and counties haven't fully dispersed the money allocated to them for from Congress to help people like Angela. What is going on there?
That is the question of the hour. What is going on there? The $46 billion is still yet to reach the people who need it the most. And I think that the states need to take some responsibility for this, because they've had, since the CARES Act and the rental assistance that was available at that time, to develop the infrastructure for rental assistance programs and to make connections with the communities at the greatest risk of harm. And so now they are on notice that the eviction moratoriums are ending and people will be displaced in masses if they don't get that rental assistance in place immediately, but also bolster it with additional assistance as well. Congress is currently considering the Eviction Crisis Act, and it would create a grant program to directly finance and help households overcome short-term crisis like this. And that type of blueprint is critical in our country, because we do not have an effective safety net to really support renters. And the rental assistance rollout is a good example of that. I think that the administration has done a good job of trying to continue to provide guidance to make it easier for people to self-attest their eligibility and to expedite the delivery of funds to the communities that need it the most.
You know, what's doubly disturbing about, you said $46 billion still hasn't been distributed. $46 billion. So that's not only just harming the renters that we've been talking about, it's harming the owners of the property as well, many of whom are small property owners. I mean, definitely I understand there is a lot of corporate ownership in the rental market, but we've been hearing from small property owners over the course of this hour. For example, Felix Eddy says, some landlords are on the verge of literally losing everything because they haven't been paid in a year. They're not huge companies or wealthy multi-property owners, but regular folks who bought a two-family and live on site. One of them is Sally Jane Smith, who sent us this message saying, my renter hasn't paid for 15 months or didn't pay for 15 months starting in October 2019. I was unable to pay property taxes and incurred several hundred dollars in penalties and late fees. The state of Massachusetts forgave $5,000 in arrears, reduced the rent going forward. And Sally is very upset over this intervention. And again, because she's almost worried that she could have lost her property. Molly Solomon, do you want to talk a little bit about that? I don't actually know sort of how much small property owners are part of the picture in San Francisco, but they too have been hurt by not being able by the money's not being distributed or not getting rent.
Absolutely. And, you know, the way that it works, it's a little bit different depending on where you live. You know, I'm obviously not as familiar as the listener from Massachusetts on how their rent relief program works. Mm-hmm. But in California, you know, the landlord and the tenant can both apply directly. And especially, I think, small property owners, you know, small mom and pop landlords, you know, we've heard from some folks who they've retired and that's like their only source of income is the couple buildings that they own or units that they have in the city. Not getting that money has really hurt them. I mean, I mentioned at the top of this that, you know, one person that we spoke with, a San Francisco landlord, you know, he's applied for rent relief for four of his tenants and he is due $150,000 at this point. And he's only got about four or five tenants in the Bay Area. So that's a huge impact for him. You know, luckily he's got some savings, so he's had that cushion, but, you know, that cushion is running out for him. And I just think, you know, especially for these smaller landlords, they've had some of these government protections with forbearance debt and, you know, being able to put off some of their mortgage payments. And that's helped a lot. But I think the concern is what happens when those protections lift too. And you know, they've got bills to pay. They don't want to have to foreclose on their buildings or sell off entirely. And I think that's a realistic fear that we've heard from property owners, especially given the housing market that we're in and what a hot seller's market it is. Why should I be sitting on a building where I'm not getting rent? Maybe I should just sell it and make a profit and walk away from being a landlord. And I think that there's some fear there. You know, could that lead to increased speculation, more corporate home ownership in this country? That could overall lead to some instability in terms of our neighborhoods and larger housing picture here. But I do want to just say, you know, the issue with the rent relief programs and, you know, the confusion and the waits that people are having. I mean, that's a big problem that, you know, states at all levels are trying to figure out right now, you know, and in California, you know, we talked to folks that renters and landlords that have been applying to these pots of money that have been set aside for them, you know, that it's just been trickling out. People have just said it's so difficult to apply. I mean, one person told me it's like a 34-page application when you print it out. You know, you got to set aside not just a couple hours, but a couple days to get the documentation, to fill it out. You know, and some renters who are doing this, they don't have internet access or it's hard to do. They don't have a computer. They're trying to do it on their phone. Maybe they don't speak English. So it's been really difficult to get folks through these applications. And then once they're finished, you know, there's a lot of security checks in place. States want to make sure that they're preventing fraud. But I think a lot of the efforts and the focus on preventing fraud has actually prevented a lot of the money from actually getting out.
Wow. Well, look, we have 2 minutes left here. We have done show after show after show about the drivers of the long-term drivers of the sort of the really crazy housing market we're seeing in the United States, and it was just accelerated by the pandemic. Issues of corporate ownership, private equity really moving into the rental market, especially lots of people point to the ultra low rates that the Fed insists on keeping. That's driving up higher housing prices. I mean, it's like there's layer upon layer here, and it seems like it's almost like, how do you start undoing it, Emily? We've just got about a minute and a half left here. There's the short-term set of solutions and longer-term solutions needed to get more affordable housing in America. So where would you begin?
So in the immediate moment, we absolutely have to stop the eviction crisis that's pummeling our country right now. And the current status quo of this slow rollout, these burdensome application processes, they don't have to be the case. There are some counties in the country that have expended their entire emergency rental assistance one funding. Mm-hmm. So we can get to that point, and there's no reason for that level of check in place to protect people from harm. And we also need to add these diversion programs that prevent people from filing evictions in this moment. We know that 81% of property owners, from a study of the American Bar Association and Harvard, 81% would be less likely to pursue eviction if they could participate in these programs. So let's move to that direction with the goal of keeping people housed. And then we immediately need to start addressing this inequitable eviction system that sends people on this downward spiral of poor health outcomes, long-term harm, and even takes years off of their life. And part of that means addressing the affordable housing crisis with investing in more affordable housing for the people who need it the most.
Well, Emily Benfer, professor at Wake Forest Law and founding director of the Wake Forest Law Health Justice Center, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Molly Solomon, housing reporter for KQED in San Francisco. Molly, thank you so much, and thank you for your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.